Good evening to all of you. But it is interesting coming to a Jewish synagogue here on a Wednesday night. So Mr. Johnson was not kidding. I never know when to take him seriously. He said it was a synagogue, so indeed it is. Tonight I would like to discuss a topic with you that I have been interested in for several years. I'll try to begin by giving you a little background into my part in this particular subject and what I have done and what has occurred over really somewhat over a number of years. I won't get anywhere near into the material this evening, but I will at least give what I would consider an overview and a foundation that will help you, I hope, in any further study that you would like to make on this particular subject. But back in the fall of 1968, when I entered Ambassador College, I took, as all of the freshmen did at that time, a course called Church History, and it was taught by Mr. Ron Kelly. I was very interested in the class. I already had a desire or a love for history even before going to college, and I really enjoyed it. I guess I would have to say it was one of my favorite classes, even though the church history aspect was only a very small part of the class, the way it was taught at that particular time. The first semester was primarily the life of Christ and covering the four Gospels, and then the second semester we covered the book of Acts, and then we had about a month, maybe less, at the end of the year in which we covered church history. But it was very interesting, and I remember at that particular time saying, someday I would like to pursue a more in-depth study of this particular subject. I'd like to know more than what we had presented at Ambassador College. When I graduated from college in 1972, obviously became very busy and just kind of put that on the shelf and didn't really think about it that much for several years. Then in 1979, I was pastoring a church in Athens, Georgia, and got a call from, Dr. Meredith at that particular time, telling me that we were being transferred to Massachusetts. Now, that was a little change, as you might imagine, from Georgia. In fact, a major change from Georgia, going to Massachusetts. In fact, of course, my family, with the exception of my parents, are not in the church. And when I told my grandparents that I was going to Massachusetts, they said, well, why do you want to go there? I said, there's nothing up there. There couldn't be anything up there. You know, they didn't think beyond Missouri. That was about as far north as they could think, you see. And they thought, well, there was no such place, or if maybe it did exist, they'd heard of it, but why on earth would anybody want to go up there? And we didn't have any of those reservations. We certainly knew that there was a church there and that we were going to be serving in God's work. But we had never, my wife and I had never been that far north. Had never been up into the Northeast at all. And probably many of you here have never been up there either. It's a beautiful part of the country and just so much history in that particular area. So in getting ready to go to Massachusetts, I reflected back on Ambassador College and some of the references in church history to the fact that the first Sabbath keepers in America and the first Sabbath-keeping church in America was there in Rhode Island. So I thought, well, that would be nice to check out and to visit and see if there's anything there. And, of course, moving into a new area, again, I got busy and it didn't really, it wasn't something of urgency that I felt like, I've got to go do right now. And so I put it off again. And 1981, I went to the first refresher program. This was the very beginning of it. And during the refresher program, Mr. Blackwell gave a lecture or a discussion on the church eras. And he talked about the Sabbatarians that came over from England, settled in Rhode Island, and how that is where it all began in this particular country. Well, again, spoke with Mr. Blackwell afterward, and he said, well, I'm coming. He said, I'm going to come, and we're going to go and find these places, you and me. And I said, well, that's great, Mr. Blackwell. Of course, when I got back home, I was, what do I do now? I don't even know where they are. You know, I've got somebody coming, and we're going to go find places that I really don't even know. So I thought, well, it would be nice if I at least found out the direction we ought to go, you see. So I get my maps out, and I find these places in history books, and I say, well, I'll go look for them. So I go down to Rhode Island. Of course, Rhode Island is not that large. In fact, what is this commercial that I hear on the radio? 224 Rhode Islands would fit in the state of Texas. So, you know, how could you not find it in Rhode Island? It's very small, you see. Of course, there are only, 2 million people, I suppose, in that small an area. So it wasn't quite as easy as I had thought it would be. But I went on my searching research and found a few things. Then Mr. Blackwell came, and then he and I started visiting around, and we found a few more things. We found the building where the first Sabbath keepers met. It still exists, still there. They even have a plaque out front. The plaque has been removed. I was back there recently. It's no longer there, so most people don't even realize it. But here's the oldest building as far as the Sabbatarians are concerned in America. And so we found that, and we found an historical society that had some old records and old documents. We eventually found the church minutes from the first Sabbath-keeping church in America, dated 1692. Their actual handwriting, they recorded everything that was ever said and done, and that was a tremendous find to have that. We found a few other things, but just a little bit at a time. And of course, we could only do a little at a time because we didn't have a lot of time to do that. Mr. Blackwell stayed, I believe, a week, and we were going every day. He just about wore me out, I'll tell you. And we would come home in the evening, and having on a white shirt, you would have a gray ring across your shirt here. Now, you may not understand, well, why would you have that? It's because the books we were handling were so old, they were falling apart, and they would be falling apart, and you're standing there reading them in the library, and it ruined your shirt. And these were the kind of books that we had. We had a book up in Dartmouth, I guess, up in New Hampshire, that was 1580. I mean, the actual book was printed in 1580. And just amazing at the amount of things that were available in the basements of some of these old libraries. The Redwood Library in Newport, Rhode Island, the oldest library in America, continuously in operation, was there. Brown University was founded by Sabbath keepers, so they had a treasure trove of information in the basement of Brown, some of the libraries at Brown University, John Hay Library, and the Rockefeller Library, and some of these other places had all of this information, and we began to find it. And it was coming out a little bit at a time. It was very exciting and very interesting. But then Mr. Blackwell left, and of course I had to go back and take care of my responsibilities, so it was kind of put on hold again. And a few months later, I got a phone call from Mr. John Halford. He said, we are going to put together a behind-the-work film and would like to have some film of some of the early Sabbatarians, because we're going to begin the film with the Sabbatarians in New England and trace it across to Oregon and then to Mr. Armstrong. And we want you to help us out. I said, well, sure, anything. I'm an expert on this by now. They said, well, we want you to find the graves of the first Sabbath keepers. Now, these people died in the 1600s, and they weren't famous people. It would be like somebody giving you a name that was certainly not famous in history and saying, go find his grave. And it's not like Grant, you see, or someone like that. Go find the graves. There were 7 members of the original Sabbath-keeping church. He said, go find their graves. We'd like to find their graves. So, where do you start? Well, obviously, you start in cemeteries, but which cemetery do you go to? It was hard. I thought, well, okay, I'll see what I can do. So I went back to Newport, Rhode Island. Well, that's where the church was, so probably they're buried somewhere around Newport, Rhode Island. Now, I found one book that kind of indicated that Samuel Hubbard, who was one of the original Sabbath keepers, was buried behind his house. How do you find where his house is? Does it still exist? I mean, this man came over to America in 1664, died in, 1707. How do you find his house? Would it still be in existence, you see? So I went to the Newport Historical Society, and there was an elderly lady there that we became very good friends over actually several years. Her name was Mrs. Bullhouse. And she knew everything about everything in the Newport Historical Society. And I said, well, I'd like to find Samuel Hubbard's grave and his house. And then I said, I'd also like to find Stephen Mumford's house, if it still exists. She said, well, I don't know much about Samuel Hubbard, but she said, I've got a whole drawer full of information on Stephen Mumford and the Mumford family. In fact, I've even got his will. And so she went back searching through this old dusty safe or vault area and came out with this will from 1707, Stephen Mumford's will. and it gave the location of his house. And again, maybe he was buried behind his house, because that was not all that uncommon. So based upon the will, I found his house. But it has this huge fence around it. But at this point, a fence was not about to stop me. See, I'm walking around all over Newport and in my suit, and I'm standing out in the street waiting until nobody's looking, and I'm scaling this fence to find out if he's buried in the backyard. And I get into the backyard of this house, and it's a house that's been restored, and it's actually used for showing tourists what it looked like in the 1600s and 1700s now, but you couldn't get into the back, but I did. But I walked all around, I waded through all the tall grass in the backyard, and I didn't find a tombstone or anything. So now I'm back to zero again. So where do I go? Well, the next place I thought of looking is the old colonial cemetery, second oldest cemetery in America. 1635, there were people buried there from that particular period. Well, how big could this place be, I thought? Because they told me, well, you go down Falwell Street, and it'll be on your right, can't miss it. The Jewish cemetery is on the left, the colonial cemetery is on the right. And it's on the National Registry of Historical Sites. So surely it's kept up quite well, I thought, and surely it can't be that big. And I'm going down the street, and I see off to my right this huge area of just tombstones and graves. I said, that can't be it. Sure enough, it was. 5 acres, this place is. Hundreds and thousands of tombstones. And grown up, you know, just wasn't well taken care of at all. So now, they're probably buried here. I don't know whether they are or not. Probably they are. How do I find their graves? I don't know. Well, I guess I'll just start walking. So I go, and here I am in my suit, because I'd go down and I'd go visiting in the area as well. So I go out in my suit, out in the cemetery, and I just start walking up and down, row after row after row, looking at every tombstone. I did that for 2 days. 8 hours a day, I walked up and down, up and down, up and down. Still hadn't found anything. I said, there's got to be a better way. Got to be a better way. I've already put my foot in my mouth, say, sure, bring the cameras down. I can find all these places for you. So I went back to Mrs. Bullhouse, and I said, Mrs. Bullhouse, I got a real problem. She said, well, what's the problem? I said, I'm trying to find these graves. She said, well, I think I remember an old plot map of that colonial cemetery hidden somewhere back in this vault. And she said, but I don't know if I can reach it. She was a real short lady. And I said, well, let's you and me go back there and let's see what we can find. So we go back there crawling all over books and everything. Sure enough, we pull out this old plot map. And here it is. It's a plot map of all the graves in that cemetery. 100 years old. And we pull it out and it's falling apart and we're looking. And sure enough, I find Samuel Hubbard. We never found him. But Stephen Mumford, his wife Ann Mumford, who were two of the original Sabbath keepers. Roger Baster's grave, who was one of the original Sabbath keepers. So we found three of them right there. And some of the others, we found four of them. Rachel Langworthy, who was not buried there, but was buried out in western Rhode Island, we actually found her grave, who was another one of the original Sabbath keepers. So we found actually four of them, which was pretty good, really. The reason and the interesting part about finding their tombstones is that on their tombstones, they actually refer to the Sabbath, because the Sabbath was such a very important part of their lives. Roger Baster's tombstone, actually, he carved the tombstone himself, and of course, obviously it was engraved after he died, but had engraved on there the date he died and said he was one of the original 7 members of the First Church of Christ keeping the Sabbath in New England. And all of them would have on their tombstones that they kept the Sabbath, which, again, identified to us that this was very important in their lives. And then we found Stephen Mumford and Ann Mumford and their whole family there. And it was quite interesting, to say the least, to do that. So we found a lot of this material over a period of time, and they filmed, and a very little of it was actually in the behind-the-work film, but it was there, and Mr. Blackwell came back 2 or 3 more times, and we really found a lot of information, including Samuel Hubbard's journal, which was written from about 1636 to 1686, covered a period of about 50 years. And it's quite a document. Every book we read said it was lost. You can't find it. One day we were in the basement of Brown University, and Mr. Blackwell and I said, oh, if we could only find his journal, wouldn't that be exciting? And Mrs. Blackwell is kind of leaning up there, just getting tired and yawning, and she said, and a book fell out. Now, we've been looking for weeks, you see, you know, over years, actually, two or three years, you know, various periods of time. And she said, what is this? Samuel Hubbard's journal. And it was absolutely amazing. And so we found a copy of it. Now, it was not the original copy. It had been retyped. But to have a complete copy of it was exciting. Where this Sabbatarian, Mr. Hubbard, recorded. He didn't record their birthdays, but he recorded the day they began keeping the Sabbath. And he says, my wife, Tacy, began keeping the Sabbath April 6, 1667. Daughter Rachel began keeping the Sabbath, you know, April whatever, 1668. And then I began keeping the Sabbath. And it's reading his journal is like reading Mr. Armstrong's autobiography, where his wife first became convicted, told him about it. He said, no, it can't be. And finally, about 3 months later, he records, I began keeping the Sabbath. And it's just an amazing story. So we pieced this together over a period of time, Mr. Blackwell, myself, and I gave several sermons, several Bible studies over the years in various places. And I know Mr. Blackwell used it in the Ministerial Refresher Program. We put together a little slideshow that he showed to the ministers, and I've shown in various places as well. Over the years, it became something that not only did I enjoy, but I felt it served a worthwhile purpose. Then, and this, we're coming to a little bit more of this, or we will eventually get to a Bible study, believe me. About a year later, 1983, Mr. Ron Kelly called. And he said he wanted to come out and see a lot of these sites as well. Because we found a lot of things from the old buildings to some old books that just do not exist anywhere else. And he wanted to see some of this as well because in 1983 he decided, or he felt he would like to begin a course at Ambassador College strictly on church history, as opposed to just having a course that lasts for like 6 weeks at the end of freshman Bible, to have a full course, at least for one semester, on church history. And he felt that he should come out and see this segment of church history. And so he came out, and he and I had quite an interesting discussion. He went back to Pasadena in 1983 and spoke with Mr. Armstrong about beginning this course. And Mr. Armstrong approved it, but Mr. Armstrong gave certain restrictions on it. And I usually always give some of this material when I begin any kind of Bible study on any aspect of church history. Because Mr. Armstrong set the tone for what we believe and still believe today, and I'm not sure that everybody understands what we believe about church history. Mr. Armstrong gave Mr. Kelly specific guidelines in teaching a class on church history. He said, number one, do not be dogmatic on the beginning or the ending of church eras. Do not be dogmatic on the date when a church era begins or when it ends. Now, Mr. Armstrong said, we do believe in church eras, but we cannot be dogmatic on beginning and ending dates of the church eras. We also must not be dogmatic on who is and who is not, or I should say, who was and who was not a part of the true church. It's very difficult in history to do that. And Mr. Armstrong wanted us to be very careful. We had written a booklet that probably, maybe many of you still have. I have a copy of it, the old book on the true history of the true church. And it's a wonderful book. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the book per se. But we got very specific about certain people. We got very specific about certain dates, which later on were proven to be in error. And Mr. Armstrong just said, we don't need to do that. We can tell the history of the church without being that specific on every individual. Now, there are certain individuals we can speak with some confidence about. What I have done and what Mr. Kelly does in his class is to say that the church was among these people. It is incorrect historically to say that all Waldensians were part of the true church of God. It's incorrect. Now, you've probably heard the term of Peter Waldo and the Waldensians in that era of the church. It is incorrect historically to say all Waldensians were part of the true church of God. It is more properly correct to say that the true church of God was among the Waldensians. See, that is the correct way to state it. It's a little different, but again, we're telling the same story. And the same thing holds true of various other groups that you can read of in church history. It is very difficult 200 or 300 years later to get a good feel for people and what they did and how they felt and what they taught. There's a peculiar problem to studying church history, and that is Very few eras of the church do we have a written record from. You see, we don't have a real written record from the Thyatira era. The Waldensians, we have to read from their enemies as to what they believed and did. Very hard to do. So Mr. Armstrong told Mr. Kelly, clearly, be careful in those areas. Number one, don't be dogmatic on the dates when an era begins or ends. And number two, be careful about being dogmatic on who was and who was not a part of the church. Because you could be embarrassed to find out later on a document appears that shows they kept Sunday, which was the case with one segment of the Waldensians. And then some of the other groups down through the years actually were Sunday keepers. See, there are certain things that we feel the true church has always done, and one is keeping the Sabbath. See, they may not have always kept it properly, but at least recognizing it and keeping it. So Mr. Kelly began his church history classes by giving a synopsis of the seven church eras, which I will give to you. And again, I use this to set the stage to let you know where I am coming from and where Mr. Kelly, where he comes from in his class, and really the guidelines for Mr. Armstrong. Of the seven eras of the church, we feel that there are two that we can speak about dogmatically. That is Ephesus and Philadelphia. Those two we can speak about dogmatically. Because you see, Ephesus is recorded in the Bible. Philadelphia is the era we are presently in, which we have multitudes of written information about this era. So we can speak dogmatically about those two church eras. One era has yet to appear, Laodicea. Anything we say about Laodicea is going to be highly speculative. So, again, you're going to be dealing in a good bit of speculation when you begin to speak of Laodicea. Now, that's not to say there aren't many things to learn from Laodicea. Does not mean we ignore it altogether, but it means in a discussion of church history, any discussion of Laodicea is speculative, because it's not here yet, you see. One era, we have a fair amount of documentation and therefore can speak about with some authority, and that is Sardis. But that leaves three church eras that are very vague historically. That is Smyrna, Pergamos, and Thyatira. We must be very careful in this area and with these eras. Much of the history of this period of time runs together. There are no clear-cut beginning and ending points for these eras of the church. They existed during the Middle Ages. The only information we have about them is from their enemies, which is very suspect at best. So we must be very careful with that. It's a very confusing period of history anyway. Whether you're trying to identify the history of the church or whether you're trying to identify anything else during the Middle Ages, it's a very unclear, a very cloudy period. And again, it's called the Dark Ages. I mean, there's obviously a reason for that. That is Mr. Kelly's approach, as he expressed to me, and it's the same approach that I have adopted over the years toward the subject of church history. And when I give sermons or Bible studies or show slides about the Sabbatarians in New England, I refer to them as Sabbatarians. I don't believe all of them were a part of the true church of God, because I read enough about them to see that some of them probably were not. But I also know that the true church was among that group of people. They were there, you see. But I can't say that every single one of them. See, I can read some of the old records, and I can find out that a segment of them broke off and refused to use alcohol at all when it came to the Passover. They went to grape juice. They went to six times a year with the Passover, or the Lord's Supper, as they called it. A lot of different things you begin to see. It would be very nice if you could pick up a book and find out that the group of people that came over and kept the Sabbath, met for Sabbath services at 10 o'clock in the morning, had an opening prayer, had songs, had a sermonette, had announcements and had a sermon, and had closing songs and closing prayer. I mean, that'd be wonderful if we could find that. Fact is, they didn't do that. And so then you've got to try to identify what they did do and see if it meshes with what the church should be doing. And there are some problems. There are some problems and some questions that we just simply have no answers for. I visited some of these areas in Rhode Island and in Massachusetts quite a few times that I really felt comfortable with, as though I knew these people. You know, they no longer became just names to me. I went over to a place called Boom Bridge, which is where the Sabbatarians in Connecticut crossed the Pawcatuck River to get over to Rhode Island to go to church on the Sabbath. Boom Bridge got its name because there was no bridge there, and they had to go way upstream to cross over several miles So they felled a tree that across the Pawcatuck River, and they had to cross that tree to get over. It was a shortcut to services. And they have a lot of records. They wrote everything down at this particular period of time. And they record people coming to church soaking wet. And everybody knew they fell into the Pawcatuck River on their way to church. All of their churches were built with the entrance to the hall behind the pulpit. See, so you didn't dare come to church late. If you did, you had to walk right by the minister while he was speaking. There was no back door. The only door was right behind where the minister was speaking. Every one of their buildings was set up the same way. And they were very strict in observing the Sabbath. And you were at church every Sabbath, you see. If you missed two Sabbaths in a row, three Sabbaths in a row, the third Sunday, all the ministers showed up at your home. Find out what's wrong with you. Where have you been? If you could not give them a good excuse, they gave you a written letter of admonition. And there are a whole book full of written letters of admonition. And they would write down what you've done wrong. I mean, it's interesting to read some. I've got some slides that show these letters. And they begin something like, to our dear brother Darren Potter. Brother Potter was seen in a place getting drunk last Sunday night. He also did not come to church last Sabbath. This is a written letter of admonition. They would quote the scriptures about admonishing the sinner. And that would be it. Now, if you responded to that, and this was public record, this was put into the church minutes. And if you responded to that and got everything straightened out, then that was fine. If you did not respond, the next thing you got was a letter of disfellowship. And that was it. And you either kept the Sabbath and you abided by the teachings of the church, or you did not go to church there. Very strong church government. Very strong. You did not come to church unless you were invited. There was no open door policy. You had to be invited by the minister to come to church, which even at that period of time was totally different than the other churches. But they believed they were special, you see. And when the first seven members began the first Sabbath-keeping church in New England, actually in this country, they started out with 11. They used to meet with the Baptist church in Newport, Rhode Island. When Stephen Mumford came over in 1664, he met with the Baptist church, the first Baptist church in Newport. And some say, well, how could he do that? Well, if you read the Baptist doctrines in 1664, you'll know why. They didn't believe in going to heaven. They believed in ruling on this earth. They didn't believe in burning forever in hell. They didn't believe in the immortal soul. They even drank back in those years. And this is the beginning of the Baptists. Most Baptists don't even realize some of the doctrines of the early Baptist churches as they were in New England, where they began with Roger Williams and some of the others. So Stephen Mumford came over. There was no church here. So he began fellowshipping with the Baptists on Sunday, and he kept the Sabbath at his home on the Sabbath. Well, there were 11 members that were eventually keeping the Sabbath in his home. Four of them decided, after a sermon that was given, Obadiah Holmes, who was a pastor of the associate pastor of the First Baptist Church there, gave a sermon attacking Sabbath keepers. Four of them quit keeping the Sabbath and went back to Sunday. Now, the Sabbath keepers had a problem. Stephen Mumford had no problem fellowshipping with people who had never been in the church. But now, for the first time, there were people who in their eyes had been in the church and left the church. And they decided they couldn't go back anymore. And that's when they began their own church in December of 1671, the first group of Sabbath keepers in America. It started out with seven members. And it's just an amazing story of what they went through. So all of this material does, to me, point out some very important lessons and a lot of things that I try to discuss in various opportunity sermons and other things. And we don't have the time or the opportunity to go into some of those things. So I would like to back up a moment and give what I call a foundation to a study of church history. I'd like to give you some basic material, very basic, from God's Word and from the historical works, showing where you should begin. And my point is, if you would like to study church history, where do you begin? Well, you might say, I'd like to begin up there where you were, in Rhode Island. I'd like to get a lot of that interesting things. Well, that's nice and that's interesting. But unless you begin at a proper point, at what I would call a foundation to a study of church history, then I don't think you're going to fully appreciate what you find in Rhode Island in the year 1671. You need to go back a lot further, about 1600 years or so, to find out where it began. And how do you find the true church? You know, what do you look for historically when you're looking for the true church? Well, you need to go back and find out what the church was in the beginning. And there's a great misunderstanding as to what the church was like. So let's back up historically to the first century, which is commonly called the beginning of the Christian era. The first century in the Middle East, historically, was certainly an interesting area. The world at that time was dominated by the Roman Empire. The Romans dominated everything. The Roman Empire was obviously pagan. And yet in the Middle East, you had the Jews who were under the subjugation of the Romans. So on one side, you had the Jewish religion, and on the other side, you had the heathenism and the paganism of Rome. But Rome controlled the Middle East in the first century. They certainly controlled Palestine and the Holy Land. The king was really a puppet of the government of Rome. The real ruler of the Holy Land or Palestine was what was called the proconsul or the governor, who was appointed by the emperor. So they control all of that. During the period of time from the end of the Old Testament, you know, you read of the book of Malachi. Malachi lived around 400 or so B.C. We don't find anything else recorded in the Bible until you get to the first century. So there's about 400 years there that's called the intertestamental period of time, in which a lot of things were developing. The Jews developed during that period of time a very elaborate religion, which was quite different from the religion of the Old Testament when you analyze it. They developed this a system to keep them holy, I suppose, would have been their idea. But not only did they develop a system, they developed groups. They developed sects, or we might consider today like political parties. You know, as we have Republicans and Democrats today, the Jewish religion developed Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes primarily, were the three primary groups. There were also the scribes. There was also the Sanhedrin. There was also the term publicans. All of this developed during this intertestamental period of time. This is the stage that's being set for the first century A.D. and the beginning of the Church of God. Let's open our Bibles to Matthew, the 23rd chapter. And there's a verse here that bears reading in regard to the setting for the beginning of the church. Yeah, I'm going to take you back to the beginning of what we would call the New Testament period of time, or the beginning of the church in the New Testament. This is not the beginning of the church. Technically, you'd have to trace the church back to ancient Israel. You know, we are told in Acts that that was indeed the congregation in the wilderness. So the term church or called out ones would go all the way back to Israel. But we're dealing with church history we deal with from the first century onward. I think we all understand that. We don't have the time, nor do we need to go back further than that for what I'm going to cover this evening. But Matthew chapter 23, we find in verse 1, "Then spoke Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples." A very important point to make right here. Christ said, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. But do not you after their works, for they say and do not." Now, why is this important? Because in spite of this elaborate system, which was not given in the Bible, that had been developed by the Jews, Christ gave them authority. Not that he gave them authority. Certainly, I guess you could say he did. But he gave them credibility. That's the word I'm looking for. Christ gave them credibility. Not because of what they did, but because of where they were. They were in what? Well, they were in control of the temple and the worship at the temple, which was the church of God, you know, I put that in quotation marks, of Christ's day. And what did Christ say? "They sit in Moses' seat. All they bid you observe." Even though some of the things they were telling them to do were not, you know, they certainly were rather ridiculous, those that were not contrary to God's Word, and everything that along that line would have to fit within the framework of it, is it contrary to God's Word? And what they were teaching the people was not directly contrary to God's Word, teaching such things as, well, you can't kill a fly on the Sabbath, you see, unless it bites you. You know, all kinds of rules like that that they came up with. So Christ said, you listen to them, you keep the Sabbath, you obey God, you go to the temple, you worship at the temple, and Christ went to the temple but you don't do as they do. He really condemned them for their actions, but he also gave them credibility. He said they are in the position of leadership in the church. And it's very important, very important. It's going to be from this church, so to speak, in which is run by the Pharisees at this time, that the church of God is going to come from. And it's going to be very important in understanding where the church is later on. You know, we have to get this background to understand how to identify the church. You know, how would you identify the church if you picked up a book and you read about, in the 4th century, you read about a group of people? How do you know if they're of the church or not? Well, you got to find out what the church was like, how it began, what it was intended to be. Then you can more properly understand church history. Let me give you a little more information on these various sects, such as the Pharisees. Here's some historical data on the Pharisees. The sect of the Pharisees is thought to have originated, and a lot of this is just from various Bible dictionaries, so it's not unusual material, but just to put it together in a perspective for you. The sect of the Pharisees is thought to have originated in the 3rd century B.C., again, during that intertestamental period. In the days preceding the Maccabean Wars, when under Greek domination and the Greek effort to Hellenize the Jews, there was a strong tendency among the Jews to accept Greek culture with its pagan customs. The rise of the Pharisees was a reaction and a protest against this tendency among their fellow countrymen. Their aim was to preserve their national integrity and strict conformity to the Mosaic law. They later developed into self-righteous and hypocritical formalists. Very formal, very much letter of the law and even beyond. The Sadducees. The Sadducees as a sect are thought to have originated about the same time as the Pharisees. See, the Old Testament says nothing about the Pharisees and Sadducees. They didn't exist when the Old Testament was recorded. They came into existence between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New. See, this is the fertile ground in which God is going to plant His church. Very important. This all plays a part in it, as I hope to show you. The Sadducees were guided by secular considerations and were in favor of adopting Greek customs. They took no part in the Maccabean struggle for their nation's liberty. They were a priestly clique, and though they were the religious officials of their nation, they were avowedly irreligious. They were not numerous, but were wealthy and influential. To a great extent, they controlled the Sanhedrin, even though they were rationalistic and worldly-minded. You read about the Sadducees in the Bible. They also did not believe in a resurrection, you see. They believed, get it now. Get everything you can get it now. Very materialistic, the Sadducees were. The scribes were copyists of the Scripture. It was a calling of very early origin, and the term scribe does go back to the Old Testament. You read about various scribes. Their business was to study and interpret as well as copy the Scriptures. Because of their minute acquaintance with the law, they were also called lawyers and were recognized authorities. They were quite numerous during the Maccabean period, again, the intertestamental period, and became very influential among the people. Theirs was a vocation of great importance before the days of printing. The Sanhedrin, you've heard that term as well. The Sanhedrin was the recognized leadership of the Jewish people in the days of Christ. It is thought to have originated again in the 3rd century B.C. It was composed of 70 members, mostly priests and Sadducean nobles. Some Pharisees, scribes, and elders, tribal or family heads, and they presided over, it was presided over by the high priest. It was a council. Now, Christ was brought before the council. It was probably the Sanhedrin. Now, even though the term isn't directly mentioned, it was probably the Sanhedrin that he was brought before. They had no legal authority in Rome, but they had a great deal of religious authority. They controlled the religious thought. Again, that developed after the end of the Old Testament. All of this came into being in that interim period. The term publican was simply referred to the tax collectors. I won't go into any more on that. The other group, and the only other group that's really of any consequence in the New Testament, were the Essenes. The Essenes were simply Pharisees in the superlative degree. They were strictly organized and followed the practices of asceticism. Their origin is obscure, but Josephus first mentions them during the time of Jonathan the Maccabee, about 150 B.C., and speaks expressly of Judas as an Essene. They had no slaves in their midst. Swearing was forbidden. They forbade anointing with oil. Bathing in cold water was compulsory before every meal, 3 times a day. And great modesty was practiced. although not specifically mentioned in the Bible, they are alluded to in several passages. The ascetics of the New Testament would have been the Essenes. So here you have first century, when Christ is born, and Christ was born a little bit before that technically, around 4 BC. Christ is born into this society. It's a structured society. You have a Sanhedrin, you have a high priest, you have the temple is still there. It was remodeled by Herod. It's in existence during Christ's life. This is where the religion centers around. You've got the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, the publicans, and the scribes. A well-organized religious system. Christ is born. He obviously grows up in this society. Here as an adult, he says, they are to be looked to. Now, Christ condemns them, but he says, they're to be looked to. This is the church at the time. And it's where Christ went to worship. It's where his family went to worship. So he gives them credibility. But now something else is going to occur. Let's take a look now at Galatians chapter 4. This is a setting for something unusual which is about to happen. Not only is Jesus Christ coming on the scene at this particular time, but a church is going to be established which will break away from the temple. And that's shocking because since the time of the tabernacle, there has been one religion, primarily, that could be related to God. And it went all the way back to Moses, the people who were in power at this particular time. Something unusual is about to happen. Galatians chapter 4, and this is fertile ground for this to occur. Galatians 4, verse 4, a very important verse in understanding church history. It says, let's begin in verse 3. Even so we, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world. But when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law. Now, I want you to zero in on this one expression, when the fullness of the time was come. That's a rather awkward expression that simply means when the time was right. In other words, when the time was right, when all of the elements were in place, when it was the right time, Christ came. And the point we're making here is that God has a timetable. God does things on time. Now, you and I could sit here and we could speculate and we could say, wouldn't it have been nice if Christ had come during the flood? And the whole world is about to be destroyed. That would have seemed to us to have been a good time right before the flood for Christ to have come as the Messiah, wouldn't it? Save the world. What about during the captivity of the Jews? Wouldn't it have been nice if Christ had come then? Wouldn't that seem like a good time for it? Well, the point I'm making is that you and I don't see things the way God does. God sent His Son, Jesus Christ, as it says in Galatians 4, Paul is inspired to say, when the time was right, Christ came. And when the time was right, the church was founded. When it came time to depart from the temple and establish the church of God, that's when it happened. And you can carry that thought on through and say that when Christ returns, it'll be the right time. God has a timetable, and everything is done according to that timetable. Church history fits within that timetable, you see. When the time was right, when all the elements were in place. And I just gave you a few of the elements that were there. The church existed. The temple was there. But there was a terrible problem. Terrible problem. It wasn't the church that God wanted. But until they were replaced, that was the church. And Christ gave them credibility. Which, you know, there's even a lesson there that we can learn, but that's not our point this evening. Now let's go to Matthew 16. These are some critical verses in understanding church history, in my opinion. And getting a view of what's going to happen. The point being from Galatians 4 that nothing is haphazard when it comes to the history of God's church. Nothing is haphazard, you see. Things happen for a purpose. God is in charge. God has controlled the history of His church since it was founded. We must believe that. Now, that doesn't mean God has not allowed the church to make mistakes. It doesn't mean that the church has a perfect record in everything. But it means that God has always been in charge. Always. And that God is going to see to it that things happen in a certain pattern and a certain way eventually. And that's what Galatians 4 says, when the time was right. When the time was right. Matthew chapter 16. Christ prophesied the founding of the church. Now, the apostles, at least based upon what we see of their lives, didn't fully understand a lot of things that Christ said. And I'm sure they did not fully understand the extent when he said he was going to found a church. We find here the discussion at the beginning in verse 13. He asked the disciples, well, who do people say I am? And they had various answers. And then Peter said, well, you're Christ, verse 16, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said unto him, blessed are you, Simon. That's wonderful, Simon. And it's like Christ was surprised that he actually said that. And, of course, you have to understand Peter had flashes of these wonderful things, and he had other flashes, too. Just follow his career during this particular period of time, and you see that. But he was right on here, and Christ praised him for it. He said, flesh and blood did not reveal that to you. It came from heaven. Peter recognized it. He said it, and Christ praised him. Then verse 18, Christ took this moment to say something very dramatic. He said, I say to you, Peter, or I said, I say to you, are Peter, and upon this rock. Now, I don't think we need to go into detail to explain that he was talking about himself. You know, you can go through a study of the two Greek words here, the one for Peter and the one for rock, and it's obvious Christ is talking about himself. The church was not founded on Peter, except as Peter, as one of the apostles, was a part of the foundation. The church is founded on Jesus Christ, or it is not the church of God, you see. Could not be founded on a man, had to be founded on God and on Christ, or on Christ, and had to be founded at the right moment. See, the point I'm making about church history, and I'm trying to give you just some general things to hopefully help you as you study church history, is that things happen for a purpose. They happen at the right time. It wasn't accidental that the church began on the day of Pentecost in 31 A.D. It was not an accident that Christ was born when he was born. You know, it wasn't God said, well, we can have this happen at any time. Let's roll the dice or whatever and see what date comes up. Well, that'll be a good date. Let's do it then, you see. There's a plan. You know, who knows? And our minds cannot conceive of infinity. God and Christ have been around for all eternity. They had a long time to plan this out. See, they had a long time to plan this out. And it's planned. It's planned. Christ was planned to come before the foundations of the earth, the Bible says. And it was planned to come at a certain time. The church was planned before the foundations of the earth, and it was planned at a certain time. So church history is planned by God. It's not haphazard. So we find that the church is to be founded. He says, I will build my church. Now, as a Jew of that day would think, well, why would you build a church? The temple's here. And that's why I'm saying I don't think the apostles understood what he meant. Now, they understood the word church, it meant people. See, but he says, I'm going to build my people, I'm going to establish my people, but the temple's here. And all the Jews are God's people, you see. And they all go to the temple. So I have to believe that Peter and the apostles did not fully understand this statement. But Christ is prophesying the beginning of the church. He says, I will do it, and, very importantly, the gates of Hades or the grave shall not prevail against it. So here are our marching orders for church history. It was founded by Christ, the church was. It will never die, Christ said. And, of course, there's another verse, we won't necessarily go to it now, in which Christ said he would always, referring to the disciples, always be with them, and, of course, always be with us as well. So the church has never been left leaderless as far as Christ is concerned. It's gone through crises, but it's never been left leaderless. Christ has always been there to lead the church. To lead the church. A couple of other verses that tie in as well. Ephesians chapter 4, and I'll just allude to these for sake of time. Ephesians 4 says there is only one church. You know, there's only one faith, one God, one baptism. There's only one church. There's one body, it says in Ephesians 4. So we can't have multiple bodies. Only one. You know, again, these are all critical points in understanding church history. Ephesians chapter 2 says the church was founded on the apostles and the prophets. The church will have something to say about the Old Testament as well. So you begin to identify various things about the church. It's founded by Christ. It was founded at the right time. There's only one. There are not several. It has always been led by Christ. See, Christ has always been the head. It makes use in its foundation of the Old and the New Testament. These are all critical to understanding or identifying the church down through the years. And it's all found right here in the Word of God. Let's go to Matthew chapter 10. Something else that's important in establishing the history of the church, although we must, in all honesty, understand that the church did not always understand this point that we're going to bring out here. But in the beginning, the New Testament church was well organized. Now, you read a lot of books that talk about how the church was just kind of haphazard and they just were kind of spread around, and sure, they were persecuted, and sure, certain things occurred that are recorded in Acts. But how did God begin the church, or how did Christ begin the church? 12 apostles. Not 11, not 13. In fact, it was so critical they have 12 that Peter stood up and said, we have to replace Judas in Acts 1. You read that there? Why did he have to replace Judas? Well, God had a purpose. God had a plan in mind. It required 12 apostles. Now, some say, well, that's because there were 12 tribes of Israel. Well, okay, you could say that if you want. Certainly, they're going to rule over the 12 tribes. But technically, you could say there were 13 tribes of Israel. So why not 13 apostles? You know, Joseph was Ephraim and Manasseh. No, the 12 was more significant than just having to conform with the 12 tribes of Israel. There had to be 12. It was organized. Dr. Hay, as far back as the 1960s, wrote an article entitled, Where Did the 12 Apostles Go? In which he clearly says that Peter was the chief apostle, even as far back as that, in an old article. The point he made there, though, was that Peter was an apostle, so were the other 11, but Peter was like the jury foreman, and the apostles were like a jury, and Peter was the foreman, or the spokesman, so to speak, for the group. And that's exactly what you find in the first 10 chapters or so of Acts, as far as Peter's part. But here's a point in Matthew 10 that I wanted to show you. He called the 12 disciples. He gave them power in verse 1. And verse 2, it says, Now the names of the 12 apostles are these, the first Simon, who is called Peter. Now, there's some controversy over this particular verse. The word first there comes from the Greek word prothos, P-R-O-T-H-O-S. It can mean either first in importance or first in chronology. Well, which does it mean? Well, Simon Peter was not the first apostle chronologically. Was he not the first in degree? Was he not the chief apostle? Is this not showing that in the very beginning God intended for there to be church government? Well, we believe it is, and that God intended that from the beginning, that there to be a form of government, not just a haphazard group of people. This is important as well, because most churches develop, not the true church of God necessarily, but most churches develop around what is called the episcopal form of government, or the congregational form of government, and that's not where God began. Where did God begin with His church? He began with the leaders first and went down. He didn't begin with the people and then vote for the leaders, did he? He began with the apostles, then called the people. The government first, and that's God's pattern, isn't it? Even in the world tomorrow, what are we to become? Kings and priests. So God is developing the government first, then He will provide the people later on. So Peter was the chief apostle. Again, do we have other evidence of that? Well, let me just give you a few facts about Peter. With, I believe, only one exception over in the book of Galatians, Peter is always listed first. In fact, he is always listed first when all of the 12 apostles are listed. He's always listed first. Now you say, well, they're listed in the same order all the time. No, they're not. Read it carefully. There are two different patterns given from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You'll find the middle four are going to be changed. But Peter's always first. Always first. Peter gave the first sermon on the day of Pentecost. Peter made the decision about replacing Judas. You ever read that account in Acts 1? Read it sometime. Peter stood up and he said, we've got to replace Judas. He didn't vote on it. He didn't say, what do you think? Do you think we ought to replace Judas? He quoted two scriptures from the book of Psalms, and I would challenge anybody who didn't know what it said in Acts to go back and read those two verses in Psalms and get out of it what Peter got out of it. Peter read two verses, he pulled out of context, took right out of the middle of Psalms, and said, we have to appoint another apostle. Now, you wouldn't have gotten that just reading it. Peter didn't say, what do you think? You think we ought to? Peter said, we're going to, and this is why. No discussion, no question. He said, now give me some suggestions, though. And they suggested two men, and so they prayed over it, and Matthias was selected. Peter made the first decision, even before the church was founded, the first decision of the group of people was made by Peter. 120 gathered together. Peter decided. Peter baptized the first Gentile. The commission was given to Peter before anyone else, back in John, where Christ said, feed my sheep. Peter was told to strengthen the brethren when he was converted. Peter gave the decision at the very first ministerial conference. Christ said that Satan desired to have Peter. Didn't say that of the others, did he? Christ told Peter, says, Satan desires to have you and sift you like wheat. Peter was a little, there's something different here, you see. The first act of discipline in Acts chapter 5 was done by Peter. Ananias and Sapphira. The angel told the women to go back and tell Peter and the others, it says, when they found the tomb empty. And the first apostle to the tomb was Peter. And you could just go on and on as Peter occupying a very important position. Very important in the establishing of the New Testament church. Now, let me give you some other things. Why was the church established, though? What was the purpose behind it? Some might say, is it not possible to be just an individual Christian? You know, is it not possible just to obey God and sit home, I guess, and keep the Sabbath at home and do all of these things and you'd be all right? Is that not possible? I suppose some could argue that, but you really are hard-pressed to find it in the Bible. You find in the Bible that salvation is a gift, don't you? But it's a gift that's given to whom? Well, we're told those who work, or who are working. Doesn't it say that in Matthew? That blessed is that servant who is so doing when he comes. There's something to be done. What work did Christ give to the church? What is the work of the church, you see? And can it be done by an individual? Or must it not be done by an organized body? See, our point is that there was a purpose for establishing the church. There was a need at that time in history for the beginning of an organized work of God. What was it to do? Well, let me give you seven things, or seven commissions, or you might say seven purposes for the church. Again, important in identifying the church later on. Number one, very simple. The church, there needed to be a church for the preaching of the gospel to the world. Matthew 24, verse 14. See, I don't believe, if you read the Bible carefully, that you will find God being satisfied with a Christian or a person who professes to be a Christian who kind of sits off by himself on the sidelines. There are those people who've left the church of God and they think they can be pleasing to God because they still keep the Sabbath and maybe they still keep the holy days and they still do all these things. But their statement is, and I've heard this said many times over the years, well, I believe in the teachings of the church, but I don't want to be a part of an organized group, you see. I don't like organizations. I don't want to be a part of an organization. Organizations are of men. Men make mistakes, and I don't want to be a part of that. I'm just going to obey God. I'm going to keep the Sabbath, and I'll keep the holy days, and I'll do all these things. But when you read the Bible, you find that attitude being condemned. Because, you see, there's a work to be done. What did Mr. Armstrong tell us over and over again? God called you now. Why? Not for salvation. Now, yes, you will be saved. Yes, God will give you salvation. But to do the work. To prepare, you know, the way. Of course, we'll get to that in a moment. But first of all, preaching the gospel to the world requires an organization. You can't take the gospel to the world by yourself. Number two, we're told in the Old Testament that before the end time, God will send a watchman to the world. Now, again, it takes more than one person. It takes an organization. It takes a work. Number three, in Luke, the third chapter, we're told that just as John the Baptist prepared the way for Christ, there must come a work to prepare the way for the kingdom or the second coming of Christ. Can you do that alone? Can you by yourself prepare the way for the kingdom of God? How would you go about it by yourself? What would you do? Well, you could pray. Well, what could you do? What could you do to help prepare the way for the kingdom of God by yourself? It requires a work. It requires a body. Number four, Malachi chapter 4. It is prophesied that there will be a work that will teach God's laws to the people. How many people can you teach God's law to by yourself? Well, not very many. But as a body, how many people can we teach God's laws to? Millions. Millions. Number five, Isaiah 58, verse 1. We are to tell Israel her sins. Israel is a nation, not a person. We're to tell her her sins. How can you do that by yourself? Well, you can't. See, it requires a church. It requires a body. Number six, Matthew 28, verse 19. We're told to teach and baptize people all over the world. How many people could you baptize by yourself? Not very many. How many can we baptize as a body? Thousands. Thousands. All over the world. And number seven, we're also told in Luke 1 that we are to prepare a group of people, not a person, but a group of people for rulership. We're preparing a people for God. How can you do that by yourself? In other words, you look at the Bible, you realize there had to be a church founded. It had to be founded by Christ, and it had to begin when it did, at the right time. It had to develop, and it had to do a work. Therefore, it had to be organized. It had government in the beginning. You can identify it at that particular time. Let's go to Acts chapter 2. We come to the period of time when the New Testament church is actually founded. All this is just preliminary material to the founding of the church. We're not going to go into the founding of the church necessarily, but I'd like to show you something that is said about the church right after it is founded. Maybe something you haven't thought about. All of this, again, is material to help you identify the church historically. See, my point is very simple. If you can get a clear picture of what the church was that was founded by Christ, what was it really like? Then that's what you look for down through the years. So that's what you look for. You look for a copy of that. Now, you will never find an exact copy of it. The closest you're going to find is the church today to being an exact copy of what you find here. But if you don't know what's here, how do you know? There was a book written back about 1920s, 1930, History of the True Church by Duggar and Dodd. Probably some of you have seen that book. You probably read that book and, you know, well, here all the, look at all these Sabbath keepers. You know, they claim Benjamin Franklin was a Sabbath keeper. They claim all these people were Sabbath keepers. It's not true. It simply isn't true. They were not Sabbath keepers. They, in their enthusiasm, Duggar and Dodd, to give a history of the church and the Sabbath, they claimed, as they say, everybody and his dog as Sabbath keepers, you see. But that's not true. And in some cases, the Sabbath keepers they claimed were not a part of the true church. You can prove that as well. The point I'm making is just to pick up a book and say, they say, well, you know, Benjamin Franklin kept the Sabbath, this person kept the Sabbath, all of our forefathers believed in the Sabbath. First of all, historically, it's not true. Secondarily, what does that prove? If you don't know what the church was like that Christ founded, you don't know what the church is going to be like historically. And you won't know what to look for. And so somebody comes along and tells you, well, this is a part of the church, and that was a part of the church, and the church did this and that. How do you know? Unless you know what's here. What was this church like? Well, it was founded on the 12 apostles, or they were part of the foundation, and the Old Testament, the prophets. There was government. And here's something else. Acts chapter 2. After the church was founded, notice what it says. In verse 42, and they, these 3,000 people that were baptized, continued steadfastly. In what? In the apostles' doctrine. The apostles' doctrine. With the founding of this new church, these apostles have the authority to set policy and, yes, even set doctrine in this church. Now, again, their doctrine cannot conflict with the Bible or God's Word. But they are setting doctrine. From the very beginning, they're setting doctrine. And fellowship, and in breaking of bread, and in prayers. And fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done by the apostles. God marked the beginning of His church with many miracles. And verse 44, and all that believed were together and had all things common. And again, they were not communists per se. This was the beginning of the church. Now, if you were going to start a church or an organization, consider yourself. What do you need most at the beginning? Capital, don't you? I mean, here's a church that suddenly went from 120 to 3,120 in one day. Now, what do you do with them? Where do you go from here? Well, you need money. You need funds. You need material. You've got to get started. You've got to get founded. They sold their houses. Yes, they did. They gave their money. But you understand the circumstances. This was day one of the Church of God. And they needed help. And people who were moved by God, they were not told they had to do this. Where does it say they were told to do this? It says they sold their possessions, verse 45, and their goods, and parted them to all as every man had need. Sure, they took care of their needs. They also funded the work. And they continued daily, notice this, verse 46, with one accord in the temple. They didn't leave the temple. Now, this is the church of God, and they're still in the temple. What does that tell you? Well, it tells you one thing right off, that their beliefs are not that different from the fundamental theology that God gave the children of Israel. In fact, it is close enough that they can continue meeting in the temple without a problem. And you're going to see that they did that for many years. They continued daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house. They'd eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God, having favor with all the people. These are Jews. The Jews didn't ostracize them. The Jews didn't kick them out. Why? Because they're still keeping the Sabbath. They're still keeping the holy days. They still believe in tithing. They still believe the temple is certainly the house that God built. Very important. This is the church that was founded by God. This is why a lot of people have trouble finding it in history, because guess what? You're going to find this group of people who continued keeping the Sabbath, continued keeping the holy days, are going to become a minority in about 100 years. And the majority who claim Christianity will be keeping Sunday, will be keeping the Lord's Supper, and will eventually evolve into holidays. And the world traces the history of the church from here through the church in Rome. But see, they're off track because they don't know what the church was like. They don't understand when it says the members met in the temple daily. They don't understand when you come to Acts chapter 3 and it says at the hour of prayer, Peter and John went up to the temple. The church has already started and they're still going to the temple at the hour of prayer. There's a close connection with the temple among these people. And that's where a lot of people go astray. They don't know what to look for. You need to look for a church that's like this church. A group of people that were not that different from the Jews in belief. Now, a lot different in practice when it came to the way they practiced their religion. And you're going to find that up until the temple was destroyed, there was still an attraction in the Jerusalem church to the temple. And they were not condemned for that, except as they tried to enforce certain physical regimens on the Gentiles. But you find, and you can read through the book of Acts, I thought I would read to you a little bit. That's kind of some of the material that I consider background to church history, because it lets you know what to look for. So you want to look for a church that resembled the Jews, really, and their religion, except believing in Christ. You want to look for a church that keeps the Sabbath. They're called Jews or Jewish Christians often in the early years of church history. They're called Judaizers later on in church history. They're called Nazarenes in church history because they followed a group that, well, they were simply called Nazarenes. They followed Jesus of Nazareth, and they were called Nazarenes later on. But they were called a sect of the Jews. Remember I said there were various sects? There were the Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, and according to the people that day, there were Christians. See, they thought of the Christians as nothing more than another sect. And they tolerated them. Now, the leadership of the Jews persecuted them, but the Jews in general did not for many years, because they were so similar. So you want to look for a church that has these things. I have a book that I came by a few years ago that I find very helpful in church history because it has a lot of quotes from a lot of various books and sources. And I'll read a little bit to you from this book. This book is entitled From Sunday to Sabbath by Samuel Bacciocci. And it was he was a Seventh-day Adventist, and he wrote a history of the Sabbath. Very good book. And he documents a lot of the history, but he describes the church at Jerusalem. And he quotes historical sources that describe it. About 3 weeks ago, I visited with a man here in Houston who, it surprised me, he was attending a church that kept the Sabbath and the holy days, kept the Passover on 14th of Nisan, believed in everything we believe in. And there's a church, there's actually a little group of people, and they didn't come out of this church. I mean, I know there are those around as well, but they didn't come out of this church. About 20 years ago, a gentleman here in Houston heard Mr. Armstrong, got our literature, believed it, and began to teach it in his neighborhood and started a church. And he's got, I think, about 15 people or so in his little church, and he meets on the Sabbath. They keep all the days. They use our literature to teach from. And this man had come out of that group. And the reason he left them is because he did not believe in the holy days. I don't know why he called us, you see, but he calls us. And he says he'd like to talk to me, and he wants me to convince him that we should be keeping the holy days. And his hang-up was Colossians chapter 2. He said, well, to him that meant that we don't keep the holy days anymore. Now, he believed in the Sabbath, but he didn't believe in the holy days. And I said, well, what would it take to prove it to you? He said, well, I don't know. I said, I can't find it proven in the Bible. Where is it proven? I said, well, it says in 1 Corinthians 5, let us keep the feast. Paul talks about going up to Jerusalem for the feast. And there's just a multitude of scriptures. He said, well, that's not convincing to me. And I said, well, what if I could show you historically that the New Testament church kept the holy days? Would you accept them then? He said, well, I think I would. I said, well, the keeping of the holy days is an historical fact for the New Testament church, not just a doctrinal statement of the church. And I began to give him some names of some books, and he said he was going to check them out, that will document for him that the New Testament church kept the holy days. I'll read just a little bit of this to you because it describes it. This is the church that you want to look for in church history. This is the Jerusalem church of the New Testament. It says, and this is Mr. Bacciocci writing, he says, what information does the New Testament provide regarding the attitude of the Jerusalem church toward Jewish worship and the liturgical calendar? Does it suggest, as some hold, that the church no longer felt at home in the Jewish Sabbath worship, therefore it had to assemble by itself and at a special time? All historians agree that the church began keeping the Sabbath, but they said they also kept Sunday, and eventually they evolved into Sunday worship. That's not the way it happened, though, I assure you. But that's the way most church historians try to present it. He says, we shall endeavor to answer these questions by considering first the place and time of the earliest Christian gatherings, and secondly, the ethnic composition and theological orientation of the Jerusalem church. He says, first of all, the meeting places most frequently mentioned in the book of Acts are the temple, the synagogue, and private houses. Read the book of Acts. Tell me where the church met primarily on the Sabbath. Either the temple, the synagogue, or private homes. Excuse me. Now, that hardly sounds like a group of people that are trying to get away from the Sabbath, does it? Or a group of people that are trying to get away from the holy days, does it? Read through the book of Acts sometime. Just do a study. Go in and underline every time it mentions meeting in a temple or meeting in the tavern, or meeting in the synagogue, I should say. In Acts 2, I just read this to you, they report that the Christians were attending the temple together. Breaking bread in their homes suggests a possible distinction between the public evangelistic preaching and private fellowship meetings. However, in chapter 5, verse 42 of Acts, it says that every day in the temple and at home, they did not cease teaching and preaching Jesus as Christ. Now, why did the Jews tolerate this? Because they were still keeping the Sabbath, because they were still keeping the holy days. They were just another sect, you see. If they did away with the Christian sect, they'd have to do it. Why not do away with the Sadducee sect? See, the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. So all this Christian group had different was that they believed in this Christ as being the Messiah. So they tolerated them. And they continued in the temple. It goes on to say that the private meetings of the primitive community, though designed to express more freely and fully the content of their faith in the risen Lord, are not presented in the Bible as conflicting with the services of the temple and synagogue, but rather as complementing them. Ralph P. Martin, in his book, says this. In the early days of the church's life, and this is a man who's written a church history book, in the early days of the church's life, there seems to have been no desire to leave the parent religion, at least as far as the outward practice of the faith was concerned. The author points out that the earliest Christian church looked like a party within the Jewish fold and was explicitly designated as the sect of the Nazarenes, Acts 24, verse 5. The same word sect is used in Acts to describe both the Christian party and the Sadducees and Pharisees. And the scriptures are Acts 24, Acts 28, Acts 5, Acts 15, Acts 26, all talk about this. Therefore, Martin concludes that there was nothing on the face of it which would strike strange about the congregating of like-minded Jews as a band of Nazarenes. Nothing unusual. Some scholars even suggest that externally, the primitive community may at first have resembled a special synagogue, since according to the Mishnah, it only required 10 male Jews to form a synagogue anywhere. Christ's followers, it says in Acts 1, verse 14, with one accord, devoted themselves to prayer. In some cases, they actually took over the synagogues. They're meeting there, but they're all Christians, you see. And we find later on that many of the priests, we're told, were Christians. And we find that in the book of Acts. Or I should say Paul's writings later on. Continuing on in Mr. Bacciocci's book, it says, the frequent references to the temple, the synagogue, prayer, and preaching suggest that Christian worship arose not as a different institution, and this is important, but rather as a continuation and a reinterpretation of the Jewish religious services. It was seen as a continuation, not a new beginning. It was a new beginning. It was a beginning, but the point is it was not that different. Now, again, my point, and I keep emphasizing, I don't want you to miss my point this evening, is how would you identify the church in history? What would it be like? It should be like the church Christ founded, shouldn't it? So that's what you should be looking for. And historically that helps you because they're often called Jews. Even though they're not Jews by race, they're called Jews. They're called Jewish Christians. Then what do people call you, you see? Nothing has changed in 2,000 years, has it? People have trouble identifying you as a Christian because to them a Christian is someone who is entirely different. A Christian of Christ's day or thereafter was not that different from the Jews. Of course, they were all Jews by race, primarily. It says that Peter and John, for instance, after the Pentecost experience, go up to the temple at the hour of prayer. Attendance at the temple and at the synagogue still continues, though complimentary private meetings are also conducted. Similarly, the language of the Jewish worship, sacrifice, offering, priest, elder, remains in use. It is obvious that all of these were reinterpreted in the light of their messianic fulfillment of the Christ event. There is no hint, however, that their new faith caused the immediate abandonment of the regular worship places of the Jews. Yeah. What was this church like? What were these people like here? It says, a study of the ethnic composition and theological orientation of the Jerusalem church provides perhaps the most significant data by which to test the validity of the thesis claiming Jerusalem as the birthplace of Sunday observance. Most church historians claim that shortly after Christ's death, the apostles were meeting on Sunday, on the day of the resurrection, so the church met on Sunday in Jerusalem. But they did not. See, that is a lie. They may have met on a Sunday as they did other days, but they worshiped on the Sabbath. And every book on church history, or most of them, will try to sneak in Sunday during the Jerusalem church. It is an historical lie. It is not supported by fact. There is no support that the New Testament church worshipped on Sunday. I think we know that, but that's important from a church history standpoint. Because you lose track of the church because here's a group of Christians who worship on Saturday or the Sabbath, and here's a group of Christians worshiping Sunday. Which one do you follow? Church historians have chosen to follow this other group and left this group to disappear. And that's why church history is so hard to follow. Because no one followed it. It wasn't significant. But that's the church. It's like this church, you see. It goes on to say that the choice and exaltation of James provides... Their basic attitude toward Jewish religious observances is best described by Luke's terse statement in Acts 21. They are all zealous for the law. Now, Luke describing the Christians at that particular time. There's another book written by a man named Lino Randolini on church history. This book was written in 1967. This is what he says. He says, the Jerusalem church was composed for an indeterminate time, a time period of circumcised Hebrews who appeared as a sect within Judaism. They frequented the temple, celebrated the feasts, observed the Sabbath and fastings, and submitted themselves to legal prescription and had their children circumcised. The beginning of the church did. Now, later on, the Gentiles were told that that was not necessary. You know, we don't have time to go into all that, but you read some of this and you realize that it is an historical fact of what they did. In the year AD 49 to 50, the leaders of the Christian church met in Jerusalem to deliberate on the basic requirements to be fulfilled by Gentiles who accepted the Christian faith. The council was occasioned by the dissension which arose in Antioch when certain agitators came to the church there from Judea teaching, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Acts 15, verse 1. These Judaizers apparently claimed to speak in the name of James, though he distinctly denied having authorized them to do this. To settle the dispute, it was found necessary for Paul and Barnabas to go to Jerusalem to discuss the problem with the apostles and elders. Now, this is, 49 A.D. is 18 years after the church was founded. What is it like now? It says, at the meeting there was much debate, and discourses were made by Peter, Paul, and Barnabas. At the end, James, who appears to have acted as the presiding officer, proposed that Gentiles who became Christians were to be exempt from circumcision, but they were to be notified to abstain from the pollutions of idols and unchastity and from what is strangled and from blood. For from early generations Moses had it in every city those who preach him, for he is read every Sabbath in the synagogues. That's in verse 20 through 21. The concern of the leaders of the Jerusalem church for such a rumor about Paul, and I'm breaking into a thought here, where Paul was accused of being against the law. This was in 58 A.D., and it says, and their proposal to Paul to silence the accusation by undertaking a vow of purification at the temple reveals how profoundly attached they still were to Jewish institutions like circumcision in 58 A.D. And to back up a moment to that council, there was no discussion brought up about changing the Sabbath at the council. You think that would just slip by? And yet most church history books will tell you that by 49 A.D., the church was primarily keeping Sunday. Where's the evidence, see? Not in the Bible, and not really in church history, if you know where to look. It says, how can some interpret the silence of the council on the Sabbath question, or I should say, but how can some interpret the silence of the council on the Sabbath question as the most eloquent proof that the observance of Sunday had been recognized by the entire apostolic church and had been adopted by the Pauline churches? Some will say, well, since the Sabbath wasn't brought up, that means they're no longer keeping it. What stupid reasoning. Says that such a drastic change in the day of worship had been unanimously accomplished and accepted without provoking dissension is hard to believe in view of all the other factors. Continues on, the last visit of Paul to Jerusalem in 58 to 60 A.D., to which we have alluded, further evidences the commitment of the Jerusalem church to the observance of the law. Luke's mentioned that Paul was hastening to be at Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost. And that they had spent the days of unleavened bread at Philippi indicates that Christians still regulated their lives by the Jewish calendar. Still regulated their lives. Let's see, I'm going to skip some of this. Just a couple more minutes and I'll complete this. The excessive attachment of the Jerusalem church to Jewish religious customs may perhaps perplex the Christian who regards the mother church of Christendom as the ideal model of his religious life. One must not forget, however, that Christianity sprang up out of the roots and trunk of Judaism. The early Jewish converts viewed the acceptance of Christ not as the destruction of the religious framework, but as the fulfillment of their messianic expectations, which enhanced their religious life with a new dimension. Paul's conduct also deserves consideration. Did he violate his conviction by accepting the proposal to purify himself at the temple? It hardly seems so, since, for instance, he was not ashamed to mention the incident when defending himself before Felix in Acts 24. And then here, finally, is a book by a man named W.D. Davies, who wrote a book on church history, and this is what he says, and he kind of summarizes all of this. And this is a quote directly from his book. He says, everywhere, especially in the east of the Roman Empire, there would be Jewish Christians whose outward way of life would not be markedly different from that of the Jews. They took for granted that the gospel was continuous with Judaism. For them, the new covenant, which Jesus had set up at the Last Supper with his disciples and sealed by his death, did not mean that the covenant made between God and Israel was no longer in force. They still observed, here's the church you want to look for, they still observed the feasts of Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. They also continue to be circumcised, to keep the weekly Sabbath and the Mosaic regulations concerning food. According to some scholars, they must have been so strong that right up to the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, they were the dominant element in the Christian movement. This was the church. This is what the church did. Now, Paul had to come along and, under God's inspiration, showed that some of the physical elements of Judaism were not necessary, but not the spiritual elements, not the Sabbath, not the holy days, not tithing, not even the clean and unclean meats were ever changed. And here's a church that continued to keep that. So the point to me is clear. I hope I've made it somewhat clear to you. If you have an interest in church history, you want to study church history, you want to go at it from that perspective. That God founded the church, that it is in existence somewhere today. It has always been in existence since it was founded. You should look for a church that appears like this church. Not different, but like it. Now, there will be some differences because there were elements of the truth lost. And in fact, over the next 1900 years, you will not find a church that measures up to that perfect model of the New Testament church. I say perfect by theology, not perfect by actions, you see, as they understood, as Paul added to, and as it developed, and as God showed them the truth. So we've run out of time. I certainly enjoyed coming down here. I hope that you've gotten something out of it, and there's a whole lot more to the story, and if you'd like to study it, have at it. It's a lot of fun and enjoyable. Thank you very much, and good night.